The United States and the United Kingdom have long enjoyed a special relationship based on shared values, language, and culture. Both countries have benefited economically and defensively, but as in any truly close relationship, there are points of friction, and maintaining strong ties can require hard work and compromise. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour plays a key role in supporting that relationship, and she's done so through some major transitions, pre- and post-Brexit, starting with former President Trump in the White House and into the term of President Biden. Dame Karen Pearce is former UK representative to the United Nations and currently serves as British ambassador to the United States, and we are delighted she could make time to talk with us about her work. Ambassador Pearce, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
I'm really curious about what it's like to hold your position through the transition between two U.S. presidents with such very different approaches and agendas. Presumably, your country's objectives with regard to the United States have remained unchanged. Are there some things that are easier dealing with the Biden administration and some that have become more complicated?
I think it's fair to say that, and I don't think they'd mind me saying so, the Biden administration is a more orthodox sort of administration. It has more formal processes. It is, if you like, less freewheeling. It's run on more traditional lines. And I was posted to Washington before, 25 years ago. I saw the transition from George H.W. Bush to Bill Clinton. So I had some idea of what to expect. But for younger colleagues who have only known the Trump administration, we have had to do some learning and development to explain how US administrations traditionally function, how the National Security Council works. But you're absolutely right, Chris. In terms of British objectives, America is our closest ally. We think of ourselves as America's ally number one. It's a very important relationship, deep, profound, successful, right across many spheres, whether it's person to person, whether it's business, defense, security, intelligence, foreign policy. It really covers the waterfront. And if the Prime Minister were here, he would say America is back on the world stage, and it's very important for Britain's values and interests that that's successful, and our job is to help America lead in the world and be a force for good. And those objectives are enduring whether Democrats or Republicans sit in the White House.
Many U.S. diplomats and former diplomats have lamented cuts to the U.S. State Department in recent years. Have those changes to funding and staffing affected the way you and your team do business with the United States?
Not really. I think under the Trump administration, many positions were left unfilled, and that did make it more complicated in some cases to talk through policy in advance. But I think Secretary Blinken has made a pledge to fill the positions. And then that will mean we can talk to the Americans about policy development, whether it's about the United Nations, whether it's about trade, whether it's about foreign policy in the Middle East or Asia, be able to talk to them at all levels and hopefully be able to work more closely together on the formulation and delivery of good policy decisions.
How has your job changed since the enactment, or perhaps intensified since the enactment of Brexit?
Intensified is a good word. Thank you very much for using that. Because, no, it's interesting. Not many people realize that when you're out of the European Union, of course, you have to do everything yourself. So it's felt more at the United Nations, I think, where when we usually, when we were in the European Union, we would negotiate on human rights resolutions through the European Union. So we would burden share, we'd take different dossiers each, and then we'd combine our efforts and share our efforts. When you're out of the European Union, of course, as the UK, we do all of that ourselves. So our workload, if you like, more than trebled. But there was an interesting side benefit to that. The European Union, by definition, must get consensus among all its members before it takes a position. And it's very important that it speaks in that sense with one voice. Outside the European Union, we're not bound by that consensus, but we're also more agile because there's only ourselves who have to reach agreement. So we would find that we could work with other countries like the US, like the Australians and Canada, on one set of positions, and then the European Union would have its set of positions, and they would not be as forward as those of us who only have ourselves to think about. But the interesting point was that the final consensus would end up close to the European Union position because they'd have pulled everybody further over to the middle than would have been possible if all these voices had been wrapped up in one big block. So we actually achieved more on human rights working together and pooling our knowledge and lobbying resources. And that was a good side benefit.
What are the most important aspects from your perspective of a new post-Brexit trade deal in the works between the US and the UK?
Well, we're very hopeful we will be able to resume trade negotiations for a free trade agreement and get it passed later this year. But we're also very mindful and respectful of the fact that the Biden administration want to do a review of trade policy. The new USTR, Catherine Tai, has said this. Our trade minister has been in touch with her. They keep in close touch. We are hoping to have the review soon, the results of that review soon. And as I say, we hope it will be possible to move forward at pace with this negotiation. It will be a very good sign of COVID recovery and confidence in the global economy's ability to spring back if we can get this deal. But if we can't, we'll continue as we are. We already are each other's biggest investors, and we'll continue doing that. We're doing a lot of work, particularly in Texas. I spoke to the governor about increasing our trade. So we'll manage if we don't get the deal.
Here is then President-elect Biden discussing Brexit in 2020.
We do not want a guarded border. We want to make sure we work too hard to get Ireland worked out. And I've talked with the British Prime Minister. I've talked with the Taoiseach. I've talked with others and talked with the French. The idea of having the border north and south once again being closed and require, it's just not right. We just got to keep the border open.
A real concern for President Biden, I think individually as well as for the United States. Tell us about the status of efforts to, I guess, retrofit procedures for trade across that border between Ireland and Northern Ireland.
Well, first of all, we're very grateful for the very strong support for the Northern Ireland peace process, its creation, its delivery, its implementation that we've had from successive American governments of both parties. And we know that President Biden takes a very close interest and he's discussed this with the Prime Minister. So we absolutely recognize and are very grateful for America's strong interest. At the same time, the government, Boris Johnson, has made it crystal clear that we will not put a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. The border will remain open for goods and people. In fact, people are taken care of under a long-standing agreement between the UK and Ireland, and so there's no change there at all, but goods will also be able to be free-flowing. And in order to make that happen, as we negotiated Brexit, we then also followed that with a free trade agreement with the European Union that was concluded at the end of last year, and that has special provisions for Northern Ireland. And it has a special joint commission within which the EU and the UK can resolve problems relating to the Northern Ireland border. So I think it's fair to say there have been a few teething problems. It's not a very easy thing to do to make sure that all the proprieties around regulations and phytosanitary regulations are properly preserved for both the UK single market and the EU single market. But we do have this system of reconciling differences. They are having talks at the moment, and they are making good progress on making permanent the arrangements for Northern Ireland while ensuring that trade can flow and goods can flow to Northern Ireland itself.
Are leaders in the UK concerned about the possibility that Northern Ireland might pursue independence from the UK or a reunion with Ireland?
That's provided for in the Good Friday Agreement from 1998. And there are some formulae in that agreement that talk about the consent of the people of Northern Ireland and the need to hold a border poll when a likely majority that would want to join Ireland is reached. We're not at that point yet. I personally don't think it's particularly productive at the moment to raise the question, but the Good Friday Agreement does lay out the process and the thresholds under which that might be a possibility.
You've been adamant that the UK deserves to retain its permanent seat on the UN Security Council, which some countries have argued is no longer merited. Why do you think leaders in Africa and South America in particular have challenged that longstanding privilege?
To be honest, in the UN itself, the debate about Security Council reform is more about adding countries to permanent membership rather than challenging the five of us who are fortunate enough to have permanent status there. And the reason all of this is not moving forwards, which is a pity, but it's not moving forwards because the General Assembly, so the place where all the United Nations member states meet, can't agree on the right formula and who should have the additional permanent status seats. And this has been what has prevented progress. I would say the United Kingdom's claim is historical. It's because of our contribution to world affairs currently, right across the spheres of the economy, development, security. It is linked, in my view, to nuclear power status. The five members, permanent members of the Security Council, are also the five states permitted to have nuclear weapons under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But it is not a formal link. But I think the UK's contribution means that we earn our place. We earn it daily in the Security Council, but we very much favour Security Council reform. We'd like to see countries from all the continents come onto the Security Council. We'd like there to be two seats for Africa.
Do you have in your head an ideal number of permanent seats on the Security Council?
Oh, well, this is another good question, Chris, because, you know, at one level, you could just say, well, let's just expand it to a fifth of the membership, because when the UN was first created, the Security Council was then a fifth of the then membership. But that would mean a very unwieldy body. I think there's some research that shows once you go above 30 to 40 members of any body, negotiating in the way that the Security Council does, it becomes very unwieldy. So I think most of us who favour Security Council reform think in terms of a body that is eventually around 35 members strong. It's 15 at the moment. There isn't a cap on the theoretical number of permanent members you can have. There are five at the moment. We and France favour bringing in another four, Germany, Japan, India, Brazil, plus two seats for Africa. At the moment, the African countries have not agreed among themselves who those two seats might go to.
What are Britain's most significant goals for the G7 summit it will host in a couple of months?
Well, I think the primary goal for the Prime Minister and his colleagues has to be COVID recovery, economic resilience that flows from that. What does it mean for open markets? How do we get confidence in the global economy again? What President Biden and Boris Johnson both call building back better, a UN phrase, interestingly enough, that comes from a disaster relief conference some years ago. And we really want to put the focus on how to strengthen our economies, but how to do so in a way that reinforces open societies and open markets. And obviously, we have one eye on authoritarian regimes when we say that. Another key goal of the G7 summit is to help with vaccines for the developing world as a result of COVID, and to get better at charting measures for preparing for the next pandemic, whatever it might be, and helping countries build up their resilience so that we have the systems and frameworks in place that will enable us to respond better next time. We want to pledge money for vaccines, as I say, and get those to the developing world. We want to make progress on some of the key foreign policy issues of the day around Yemen, around Libya, around Iran, and China. There's a big human rights element at the moment to do with the Uyghurs in particular. And then each of what the individual government departments, public policy on transport, public policy on health, public policy on trade, they will all be having meetings with their G7 counterparts and hopefully coming out with some agreements that will reinforce this point about confidence in the global economy and open markets.
You've lived in the U.S. before, of course, but in this case, you arrived in country and essentially went straight into lockdown. I'm very curious about how the requirements of social distancing affect the way diplomacy is carried out.
Well, diplomacy is a contact sport, fundamentally, and you can do some of it remotely. You can do Zoom calls, you can make phone calls, but ultimately, if you want to achieve your objectives, you need some face-to-face time. You need to understand another person's, another country's motivations. You need to understand what might appeal to them. You need to get across your points about your bottom lines and what you desire. And so I think you can have a mixture of virtual and face-to-face, but it's very hard to land agreements without being able to do face-to-face. So I'm looking forward to the point at which the restrictions in DC are lifted.
What have we learned about the best ways to facilitate international coordination on public health emergencies? And what do you imagine might be different the next time, God forbid, a similar crisis strikes the entire planet?
Yes, it's interesting how many warnings there were of the world needing to deal with a pandemic. And then when it came, we were all rather on the back foot. And that in itself is something very important to think about. So we are working with others in the World Health Organization to look at this, to look at what needs to be done to the international health regulations. There are some emergency health regulations that countries agree to. They're brokered and negotiated and promulgated through the World Health Organization. So we obviously need to look at those. We need to look at the transmission of information when pandemics look like appearing. One of the problems this time, as I think is well known, is that the information coming out of China was very limited and at times was disinformation. So we have to get that right. And that in turn drives whether or not travel needs to be suspended. And that's not a blanket decision. It is a decision that needs to be taken with care. It was different in the case of Ebola from the COVID virus when it first emerged. And we need to be able to bring policymakers together really quickly so that we can evaluate and assess the right measures to take. Boris Johnson's very interested in this aspect. He made his speech in the UN General Assembly this year about how we had to collaborate more, not just on vaccines, but also on health and safety measures to deal with pandemics. And that's one thing that we'll be developing through the G7 on the health minister's net. But in both G7 and G20, G20 is G7 countries with emerging market countries added, they are making good progress in getting health bodies to talk to each other and coordinating work through health ministries. So I'm hopeful that the next pandemic will find us in much better shape.
All right, I want to move to some areas in which the US and the UK are actively working together at the moment. How aligned would you say our country's positions are with regard to China?
Oh, I think they're very similar, both based on values and interests. You know, we share the US view that there are areas where we need to compete with China on markets, on trade. There are areas where we need to, if you like, contest China, which is around freedom of navigation and human rights. And then there are areas where we really want to collaborate with China. One cannot think of really solving climate change or health security, global health, without working with China. And we're very ready to find those areas. I think on commerce and trade, the most important thing is a level playing field. There isn't a level playing field at the moment. That's something that we want to talk to the EU and the US about collectively. The way is there for a normal trading relationship, commercial relationship with China, if she wants to take it. But two problems. One is the leveling gap, actually three problems. One is the level of IP theft, which is very strong, unfortunately, in China. And then the third is that a number of Chinese companies, one thinks of Huawei, have relationships with the Chinese state and the Communist Party. So fundamentally, they spy for the state, and that's not acceptable.
What would you say, how would you say China's economic strategy relates to its interest in building up the capacity for military aggression?
Oh, I think that's a hard question. I think there's no doubt that the scale of the Chinese economy and the impact China is having on very many aspects of world affairs mean that we need to watch carefully what happens on the security side. At the same time, as we reach out to China and collaborate in the Security Council. And I don't want to give the impression that we don't find ways to collaborate on issues of global security in the Security Council. We have been able to work with China on Libya. We are trying at the moment to work with China and Russia on Iran, with the E3 countries and the US trying to get together on that to get back into compliance with the nuclear agreement. But it is a very major shift in world affairs, this growing Chinese security and economic power. And it's something we watch very carefully, even as we look for ways to collaborate on those big international issues.
What about Russia? Vladimir Putin is amassing troops near the Ukraine border. President Biden has been unequivocal in condemning that buildup. Is the UK committed to defending Ukrainian sovereignty in the event those troops take any kind of offensive action?
Ukraine's not a member of NATO, so there isn't the NATO Article 5 guarantee in respect of Ukraine. And Article 5 requires members of NATO to come to each other's defense if attacked. So that guarantee doesn't exist. But obviously, we support Ukraine's sovereignty, independence. We have always been critical of what the Russians did over Crimea in 2014. And indeed, they were expelled from the G8 because of those actions over Crimea. So we share American concerns about what's happening on the border. Our ministers have been very clear about that. We want Russia to follow the international agreement around military exercises. It's called the Vienna Agreement. It specifies how you should notify neighbors of what's happening when your military exercises. So far, the Russians have not answered Ukrainians' questions under that formula, and we would like them to do so. And we will continue to watch with concern, and we will continue to talk to our close allies like the US, the French, the Germans, and East Europeans.
U.S. security professionals have ongoing concerns about the potential for Russian interference in electoral politics here. Are there worries that the Putin regime might try to similarly disrupt democracy in the U.K.?
I think we are always on our guard for such cyber and other attacks. We have increased our own capability through our new National Cyber Center. We are looking at working more closely with allies in the cyber area particularly. And yes, that would include and encompass attempts by any foreign power to interfere in UK civic life and things like elections.
How do you see our two countries working together in a different way now that President Biden has pledged the U.S. will once again work to fulfill its obligations under the Paris Agreement?
Oh, well, I think this is a tremendous opportunity. And I should have said when you were asking me, Chris, about G7, of course, climate, tackling climate change, in a way that promotes jobs and growth. That's another key theme of the G7. So I think the headlines for that are getting more countries to commit to ambitious plans for net zero by 2050 and progress by 2030. We have turned that into legislation in the UK, the first country to do so. Encouraging countries to commit to the fund, $100 billion for developing countries so that they can adapt their own domestic systems and become more resilient. Taking measures in support of biodiversity to protect areas and to plant more trees and have more nature-based solutions. Moving towards low energy vehicles and renewables, and pooling knowledge and technology on all of those things is important. But absolutely key that we keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. There's a lot of international agreement around that, but it's not universal. So the United States can help with that by the power of example. The fact that President Biden has said the US will come back into Paris is a huge boost to the big international conference, COP26, that will take place in Glasgow later this year. Britain and Italy have the honour to chair that. And I think the prospects for getting a step change in international efforts have gone up with President Biden's commitment.
Dame Karen Pearce is British Ambassador to the United States, former UK Representative to the United Nations. Ambassador Pearce, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.